Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 404.PR1503, certificate number 45509. Elf on the Shelf.
I just don't like to make toys.
No, well, if that's all. What? You don't like to make toys?
No.
Herbie doesn't like to make toys.
Herbie doesn't.
We talked about the Tooth Fairy a few weeks ago, and it kind of foreshadowed.
Primed the pump.
This show is coming out for our Patreon listeners on Christmas Eve.
Is that right?
Yeah. And for our listeners who have not yet found the gift-giving spirit.
I thought you were going to say found Jesus.
Have yet to find Jesus, but also have found it in their hearts to tithe 15% of their income to Omnibus.
That's the minimum that we ask.
This episode is coming out the day after the Western Christian holiday celebrating Jesus Christ.
But maybe they're doing the 12 days of Christmas, right? Maybe they're just in the middle of Epiphany or Advent or whatever that is.
I don't know. This is kind of a question I want to pose to you. What do you have any Christmas traditions that are either specific to your family or other than putting presents in my shoes? The two times I've ever been invited to your house, do you...
Isn't that good, though? I came over twice, and both times there was a present in my shoe.
100%.
How are you complaining about this?
Is there anything... I mean, do you celebrate anything that wouldn't be just considered cookie-cutter...
Literally, cookie-cutters.
Yeah, American Christmas. Is there anything special...
I'm sure we've kind of run this stuff down on past holiday shows, but yeah. I will say it's changing a little bit now that the kids are older.
You're embracing Satan.
And now that we're devil worshipers, Christmas is very problematic.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, it's getting really weird.
I mean, you can still reuse your mistletoe. Mm-hmm. Like, you can, you know, but not everything can get Wiccan.
You stand under the tree and shake your fist at the sky. No!
Now that the kids are getting older. Suddenly, because for a while when they were teenagers, it was like everything must be kept the same. Like they were even more tradition bound, you know, because it's the same reason 16-year-olds trick or treat. We shouldn't put them down for that. They're having a rough time.
It's the same reason I listen to the Rolling Stones.
Exactly. How much of my life is trying to recapture childhood? Who am I to complain? So, but I think now that, you know, I have a my son's about to graduate from college.
Isn't that crazy?
You know, he'll have a bachelor's in the summer, in the spring. So,
is it a bachelor's that's going to be worth anything, or is it some communications bachelor's?
No, it's an English degree.
Wow.
The world is going to be his oyster.
I thought he was going to follow dad's footsteps and be some kind of computer thing.
I have an English degree, too. Oh. And when I talk to him, his English is just perfect.
Is it, though?
It's great. Like, not a trace of accent. He's like, they're really teaching him well there.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, he's, well, you know, we here in Seattle speak the best of all the Englishes.
It's the average of all other English.
Yeah. We've come all the way to the edge of the world, and all of the best things of English
nowhere beyond, we brought with us. Nowhere beyond can teach us English, except maybe Singapore, and it's very far.
But that's on the other side. You have to go to the other side of the earth.
That's what I'm saying. Like, that's...
Well, I know, but we're at the end, right? Singapore is at the beginning of the earth.
Right, but if you know, you do know it's round, right?
What? The Earth?
The Earth?
Come on.
You still believe
you
that.
You and your whole hippie Earth thing.
But this year, for example, we were like, what if we just went to like the San Juans for Christmas, you know? And the kids did kind of revert to what?
Yeah.
A little artificial tree? Like, no, that's not where Christmas is. It's apparently it's very localized to them.
You and Mindy are ready for a tinsel-colored tree that sits on a coffee table and has some tinsel-colored balls.
The weird flocked light blue one they have in the corner of the lot for some reason.
Yeah.
And you don't think it's going to sell? It's going to sell this year to me.
Because I was never married, there was that whole period between my own childhood and the birth of my daughter where I had no obligations. And my mom and I decided at some point, let's just go get Chinese food and let's just hang with our Jewish friends and have Chinese food on Christmas and then go to the movies.
Honorary Jew once a year.
And we would go to the local, you know, Chinese restaurant open on Christmas. And it really was all of our Jewish friends like, hey, what are you doing here kind of thing. And then we'd go to the movies, and my mom and I often would just go to separate movies. She'd go to whatever the costume drama was, and I'd go to the space epic.
But that's like a couple that stays together by getting twin beds, you know, or separate bedrooms. Like you guys.
We also had separate bedrooms.
I hope so.
Yeah. But then when my daughter was born, I was suddenly thrust into this. Like, wait a minute, what? She's just a little baby. We don't have to do all. And it was the whole thing. It all came back out. All the boxes came down from the attic.
And it's true. She won't remember for many years.
But
they do. Like, you know, a lot of your earliest memories tend to be things like Christmas or vacations because there's photos of them.
Right.
And that keeps it cemented or makes you think you remember it when you don't.
And she was perfect during the pandemic, kind of the perfect post believing in Santa, but still really into Christmas and all of it. And the pandemic was so Christmassy anyway. The whole three years was pretty Christmassy. I never left my pajamas. I just sat around drinking mulled wine. And
so keeping Christmas in your heart all the year long, like Ebenezer Scrooge, that's basically long COVID?
Yeah, I guess. Or long no COVID, because I didn't have it for the first, I didn't have it the 3 years it took me, 3-4 years.
I've never heard anybody say that COVID was Christmassy, but you're not wrong.
Yeah.
Aside from all the collapse of all our institutions, it was cozy.
It was cozy. Yeah.
It was a cozy apocalypse.
Yeah. For those of us that, you know, podcast for a living, I'm in my pajamas anyway.
Nobody's writing about cozy dystopian options.
Well, see, right. That's the, I keep trying to, on this show, you know, say yes and. But what about all the cottagecore that we have at our disposal now?
I'm not aware of that happening during the Spanish flu epidemic. Were people in the late 19-teens, early 20s like, this is so nice?
Well, isn't that...
Mull me some more wine.
Yeah, that's like right...
We lost three more kids today.
I guess it's the transition from Art Nouveau to Art Deco. Let's get chrome. Let's get chrome on this.
But I guess so they were forward looking then. They were not, that's why they couldn't enjoy their epidemic.
Yeah, I think they looked at World War I and then they looked at the Spanish flu and they were like, man, we have cleared out a lot of space here. And let's build anew with tinsel Christmas trees.
But really, that kind of stuff should make you scared of the future, right? Coming out of World War I, you'd think that's when they'd be like, let's embrace flowing lily-like forms.
No, because it was, that war ended all war. Then it was time for, it was time to fly around the world on a Zeppelin.
Yeah, Italian futurists.
Yeah.
Big locomotive-shaped locomotives.
Well, your kids would have been really the perfect age to have experienced the elf on a shelf phenomenon. Did you elf on a shelf?
In my house, we do have shelves.
Yes.
Copious shelves.
You didn't have that house then, though.
Every house I've ever been in had copious shelves. Because we still had the books.
You can never have enough shelves.
We still had the books. Just not enough places to put them. And did we have elves? I don't know if we did. So we were, not only did we not have Elf on the Shelf, I don't think I was aware of it. Like, I think I thought it was fake. Like, it was just some Hallmark movie that I hadn't heard of.
Right.
I
had that same experience because I think when I first became aware of Elf on a Shelf, it was presented... I don't know who presented it to me, but
a door-to-door salesman.
It kind of snuck into the lexicon as something that maybe had been there all along.
Right.
Maybe it was a tradition from ye olde times.
If you were, oh, you must not be from the Midwest. You don't have Elf on the Shelf.
Yeah, exactly.
Your family was too secular for Elf on the Shelf, or not secular enough? Unclear.
I mean, in the 1970s, we sat and threaded real needle and thread through real cranberries as part of our December 7th celebration.
You guys really were looking backwards. You were cottagecore.
Because my mom was from ye olden times, which is to say Ohio in the 1930s. So we did popcorn strings and cranberry strings and did them all the way until, I guess, somebody found that you could get cranberry beads and use them year-round.
Simulate.
You use them every year.
You can't put them in the sauce.
Not year-round, but you can't put them in the sauce.
You could,
right?
You could use them year-round. Nobody's stopping you. It'd be kind of a weird look in May.
If you remember, we put up those cascading Christmas lights in the front, in the living room, the first year that we lived here, and they were so pretty, we just left them up all winter. And then I think on the third year, we just didn't even take them down. Like, they stayed up the whole year.
You know, one thing about Generation X being kind of the end of history generation, where we kind of thought things were fine, we incorrectly thought things were kind of fine and static, is Christmas culture was unchanged for decades. Like, do you remember growing up in our generation not having any new Christmas songs? You know, the last new Christmas song for us was
White Christmas.
White Christmas, maybe? Yeah, you know, right. It was like some 40s song.
And David Bowie sang it, and that was like such a nutty, what a nut.
I feel like I only remember the rediscovery of that.
With Bing Crosby, heard about it in the 90s or something. Yeah.
And I guess even the Christmas movies we tried to put out, like Christmas Story, that was a failure, you know? It was only a VHS audience and a cable TV audience that we, as kids, we were all still watching Christmas movies from the 40s because there was not a newer Christmas movie than Miracle on 34th Street or It's a Wonderful Life. And all the TV specials we would watch were from the 60s. It was all Charlie Brown and, you know, claymation, Rankin-Bass claymation. So we were born in this time when we thought Christmas had kind of been completed.
Yeah.
They'd put the capstone on Christmas.
It was done.
If you were a little hipper than me, maybe you had the Phil Spector Christmas record.
Doubtful.
But my house just had Bing Crosby.
We were hipper than you and we didn't have it.
We had Bing Crosby and Nat King Cole.
Oh, we did have Mannheim Steamroller though.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, so that was kind of...
Oh, that's funny. That is kind of a Christmas novelty of my childhood. That's true.
Yeah, but it was old Christmas carols just done with synthesizers.
But it just seemed like, yep, Christmas is going to be the same for me as it was for my parents and probably for my kids. And then that didn't happen. Like, just in the last few decades, you had Mariah Carey's, now that's the biggest Christmas song in the history of Christmas songs, after like a 50-year interregnum of no Christmas songs.
Paul McCartney did that one, but but not from his peak years.
Not really, yeah. And
but you know, that was true of so many aspects of our childhood. Like, I never thought newspapers would go away.
Yeah, everything's going to be the same. There's always going to be Ziggy, for sure.
I never thought that the Democratic and Republican parties would be just somewhere in the middle where sanity reigned.
Wait, you think the Republicans? Oh, you thought that would never change.
Yeah, in 1980, although my family disagreed with the Republicans, they didn't seem insane.
It didn't seem like politics might end if they won.
Yeah. Well, and Democrats too. There wasn't any sense of like, well, the mainstream Democratic Party is definitely embracing like a no police policy.
You're going to both sides this? Because yeah, both the parties are equally extreme. Good point. One party.
Don't you millennium splain me?
One party has a lunatic fringe.
Yes.
That thinks that vaccines.
I think both parties. In your brain. Both parties think that, my friend. And I'm afraid
not elected officials. Like if you take Marjorie Taylor Greene and somebody on the squad, you're going to get one party thinks there should be socialized medicine. The other party thinks the moon landing didn't happen.
Yeah. Believe me, I'm not going to debate whether the Democrats are more sane than the Republicans with you on this Christmas special.
Any other episode. Day of the year, you'd be like, You'd be like, let's mix it up. They're just as bad.
Yeah, no, let's talk about the Seattle City Council from 2017. Let's go.
But yeah, there was this kind of idea that I just felt like I was surprised in my lifetime when there were new Christmas movies. You know, suddenly like Elf is a legitimate Christmas classic.
Is it though?
Yeah, I think
so.
Oh
my God, wow. Yeah, so that was all the years that I was eating Mushu pork and just not even playing.
You were checked out of Christmas.
I was, and I really wish I could still
do they know
be,
it's Christmas?
Here we are. I know, there was that.
After all?
There was that.
You
there was
know.
The 80s Christmas weird, like, let's go to Africa and Christmas explain to them.
You didn't know it was Christmas time at all. You were at Air Force One with your mom.
It's a tough choice we make here, saving our own lives.
Isn't that We Are the World?
Yeah, right. It's Christmas, though, right?
It's not.
No. Wasn't it? It was at Christmassy. It was Christmassy? No, I guess it wasn't.
It was after the Grammys, so I think no, right?
No, it was after the...
Oh, American Music
American
Awards.
American Music Awards.
Now I have no idea.
See, that's another thing. In Gen X, we thought the American Music Awards would be the big show for forever.
I thought it was going to be the Vibe Awards, but...
Yeah.
We Are the World was released in March. So just like Cranberry Beads, you can listen to it all year round.
That's when they celebrate Christmas in the Southern Hemisphere, Ken.
In March.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Well, when my daughter was getting into Christmas, Elf on a Shelf by that point was pretty well established.
I think it got established without anybody telling me.
Well, and
it's like people were playing a prank on me.
And there is a kind of pranky aspect to it. Elf on a Shelf was a...
Elf on the Shelf.
Oh, sorry.
No less.
Elf on the Shelf.
There's just one shelf. Except there's not. I know. That messes up the mythology.
But there are a lot of internal contradictions.
It should be a shelf.
There was a family, a Georgian family, and I don't mean from the country of Georgia, but from the American state, one of the 50 states. Actually, one of the original 13 states. The state of Georgia.
Congrats to Georgia.
Good job, Georgia. A family by the name of they were the Ebersolds, and they had this family tradition, which was that some little elf doll from the Rankin-Bass era of, you know, what looked like kind of a claymation little white kid with a elf costume on.
By the way, people have said about me since I was first on TV that I look like Hermie the Misfit Elf.
Oh, you do?
I guess.
Do you want to be a dentist?
I don't mean to. Yeah, kind of. Yeah, is it too late?
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a misfit toy.
I went to the dentist not that long ago, although looking at me, you would think, what a bad dentist.
He missed a spot.
but I was complimenting the dental hygienist on her tremendous skill.
Ooh, I'm very relieved to hear you say skill at the end of that sentence.
Her steady hand, because she was removing stitches from my mouth, and I was like, you have such a steady hand. Is there a dental equivalent to the nurse practitioner or even the registered nurse?
I see, who basically has to do dentist-level stuff without a DDS.
Yeah, but is a nurse. And my dental hygienist said, no, in fact, there are dentists, and then there's a non-professional class of hygienists, but there's no, like, nurse level.
Wait, so hygienists remove stitches?
In this case, I mean, I trusted her. I trusted her more than half the dentists I've ever seen.
I mean, she's already really in there doing stuff you can't see. Like, to you, it's academic if she's removing stitches or spraying fluoride, right?
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, maybe not, though.
It seems like one is harder than the other, but you don't get a veto.
I don't think she can put a needle in me, but she could put scissors in me.
It's the same thing. Well, maybe not.
Maybe not.
The scissors are... If she's removing the stitches...
Yeah, right.
Hmm.
My daughter was born in the early 2010s, and a lot of her friends did have the Elf on the Shelf as part of their family, what seemed to be their family tradition. And I did kind of chalk it up to maybe some elder Gen X, or, you know, whatever you would call me, mid-elder Gen X, lack of awareness of anything Christmassy after 1980, that somehow this had come in through some Belgian tradition that whatever the 1982 Thomas Nast was, I missed. You know?
What was the 1982 Thomas Nast? I don't even know. Maybe
George Will.
I was going to say, it's got to be a print magazine, but yeah. Which one? Is it McCall's?
What was the one that was more liberal than the Atlantic that had that?
Harper's?
Harper's. It was Harper's was the Thomas Nast.
I guess that's true. He was probably still working there.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, it seemed so foreign to me that I was like, where did this come from? Christian bookstores? Did it come from some cable channel I don't watch? What is the tradition of Elf on the Shelf? Can you?
Well, so the Ebersolds, they had twin daughters. And they invented it, and it was Shanda and Krista.
Hmm.
And in their house, they had this little doll. And the idea was that the elf had come down from the North Pole around Thanksgiving.
Okay, this seems like new Christmas lore.
Yep, because that we didn't used to celebrate Christmas in November.
Well, also, it's their busiest time.
Elves?
Yeah, they would not be leaving the office to do individual missions.
This is a scout elf, not a... Because what the elf on the shelf does is it solves the question, how does Santa know who's been good and who's been bad? Up until the elf... We were told. What were you told? How did you solve this mystery? How does Santa know who's been a good little
he's
child?
He's making a list.
Yeah,
but he's not sure about it. He's checking it twice.
He checks it twice.
So that does imply that you know, there could be errors.
But does he have extra sensory perception? Is Santa like we know that Santa is not amoral.
We know that he's poly.
We know that he's. That he's immortal.
Yes.
And we know that he lives in the North Pole and that he knows all, and he can somehow supernaturally go all around the world on one night and give presents to everybody.
If he can visit all these people, surely he has a way of watching them.
Watching them, right. And the elf on the shelf solves this problem because he's a little guy.
Were you troubled by the mechanism of this as a child? Like how Santa would know?
Well, all of this.
If you're religious, it's very adjacent to like, Jesus knows if you're telling the truth or not.
But within a religious tradition, there's a clear distinction. Santa and Jesus are not working together, right? Jesus isn't reporting to Santa, as far as you know.
No, it'd be the other way. Jeez, John, it'd be the other way around.
But Santa
reports to Jesus.
I see.
I'm not sure when or how. Jesus is not at the North Pole.
Maybe Santa goes around and on Christmas night, he's dropping off the toys, but then he realizes some of these kids, it's too late for him to pull back. It's too late for him to go, I'm out of coal already. But then he reports to Jesus. Like, you know what? This kid kind of fooled me. He schnookered me with pretending to be nice.
Oh, I thought you were saying he would hand off the nice stuff to Jesus. You're saying he's handing off the punishments to Jesus.
Yeah, I think so. Right. Oh, I mean, I guess.
Jesus doesn't want to work on his birthday, right?
Look, there's punishment associated with Christmas, Ken.
There is.
Yeah.
Some of these kids are... Not anymore, right? We didn't have that as kids, but you would read about it in old-timey accounts of Christmas that, you're going to get coal in your stocking.
Well, you know, Santa Claus is a Anglicization of the Dutch Sinterklaas.
Right.
And Sinterklaas, I think I've talked about on the show before, Sinterklaas actually... Bad kids he puts in a sack and sends to Africa.
Jeez.
Yeah. With his...
So they won't know it's Christmas.
And Sinterklaas's elves are black, and they are from Africa. They steal children.
And often drawn... Like, even as bad as this sounds, the drawings of it are worse.
Well, and in fact, even in the Netherlands as recently as 10 years ago, Santa... When you see Santa, he's often accompanied by two... Dutch people in blackface.
I think people know this now because there's an episode of Atlanta about it.
Oh.
It used to just be you and other world travelers who knew about this.
Yeah.
Now anybody with FX or what's Atlanta on? AMC? Anybody with streaming knows.
Knows, yeah. Well, and it's tailor-made for our contemporary times when people are like, you won't believe
It's super problematic in the Netherlands right now.
But so so the elf shows up, and you're not allowed to touch him, because if you touch him, it screws up his game, screws up his magic.
He's a surveillance elf.
He's an elf who is there in your house, and he moves around every night. You find him somewhere else. He's on the bookshelf in the living room, then he's gone, and it's like a hide and seek game or a scavenger hunt game, where you're looking for where the elf is, and the elf is watching you and trying to decide if you're naughty or nice. And then at night, goes back to Santa and says, "Here's what I've found." And I guess there are scout elves everywhere. Elves.
This seems like the kind of thing that gets worse with expansion. Like when we just had the vague idea that Santa had a list, I wasn't that troubled. But the idea that he's sending someone into your house and they're changing position and tactics daily, the better to record your misdeeds. I mean, it's a Stasi state he's running.
Well, this is, as we'll see, part of the moral panic that results from the popularization of Elf on a Shelf. I think the Ebersolds thought it was acute. I mean, there's so many of this type of thing, I guess, that people have their traditions and their...
Well, a lot of families have the very similar thing of having an advent calendar
right. Every
morning. So it's a morning ritual leading up to Christmas you can do real quick before you hop on the school bus. And that's also a bit of a hide and seek, because sometimes the advent calendar is like, I got to find door number 3. Why can't I find it? You know, sometimes they're not in order.
Yes.
So there is like the hide and seek element there. They just had the genius idea to put it on a shelf.
To put it on a shelf. And it's a little, and I mean, the elf is not.
But he's not always on the shelf either, or else it would be a very easy game.
Yeah, he's hiding.
Sometimes he might be the elf in the cupboard, right?
I invented my own version of this, which was that at some point, my daughter was very into Star Wars, and I went on eBay and bought nerds.
The action figures.
You know, like 600 action figure collection. And the Star Wars fairy would visit our house and hide little action figures. Sometimes it would be Anakin in his flowing cape. Other times it would be the sort of elephant-headed character from inside the cantina, or, you know, like lesser.
Right.
And I did a pretty good job of hiding them, but my daughter, like I think a lot of kids, has this eagle eye where on a very crowded bookcase with tons of little gewgaws on it, and there'd be some little figurine peeking out from behind a candy dish, she would find it within an hour.
Was this a December tradition?
Because Christmas always delivered some X-Wing fighter or some Star Wars toy.
And you'd already have the staff for it.
Yeah, and then there'd be, you know, there'd have been, it's not like an advent calendar where she got 25 figurines.
Well, our advent calendars were always crap. They were just, you know, little paper doors that would open and you'd see a picture of a candle or a wreath or something. Woo! Too. But now advent calendars are all fancy. My kids always have the Lego ones.
Whoa.
Did you ever have those where every day it's a different little Lego guy to build?
We use the same advent calendars we had in the 70s.
Just re-tape them closed.
My mom makes really good fudge, and she built an advent calendar that was just a piece of fudge tied with a little piece of red.
We've had a candy yarn. One too.
Yeah.
But that means the kids are just eating candy every morning in December. So, you know, dad of the year.
Just like me. But so in about the mid-2000s, the twin girls, Chanda and Krista, and their mother, Carol, were kind of casting about maybe for a project. And it may not surprise you that Krista, I think this will surprise you.
I'm ready to be surprised by anything about Krista.
Krista was a host on QVC.
Oh, I actually am surprised by that.
Yeah.
I had a few guesses. So it's been years, apparently.
Yeah.
Because I was still picturing an 11-year-old.
No. They were grown now.
She wasn't a child selling press-on nails.
And Chanda and Carol said, why don't we write down our Christmas tradition of the elf in a little rhyming book? Elf on a Shelf.
So there was a decades, like it was one house did this.
Yeah.
And then nobody did it for like a decade. It was like an interregnum.
Well, so they wrote this book, and the idea was the book actually kind of came as a little kit. That was the rhyming story of the Elf on the Shelf, which gives you kind of the rules. The magic of the elf, the magic goes into the elf when you name the elf and claim the
elf. It's like
a
Cabbage Patch Kid.
Yeah. It's like, this is our elf. And I think
it seems like they've got the idea it's something you can sell when they're like, name your own.
Yeah,
that makes it magical.
And so this was, you know, they really quickly kind of constructed this as like, oh, this isn't just our family book that we're going to sell as like a kid's book. This is like a little thing. We can include the elf.
It's a marketing empire already.
And they didn't, I think, see anything sinister about it because the elf is friendly and the presumption is that if you have an elf in your house, you're a good kid already. Like there was, they did not.
He's watching your good deeds.
Yeah. And it was a, you know, you find the elf, you're like, oh, we found him. And then I don't think there was, they were not aware of what would be ultimately the future criticism of it, that the elf was something that was watching them any more than Santa or Jesus.
Or your teddy bear.
Or your teddy bear or any of the 10,000 other kind of, or any grown-up that's just like monitoring whether you're fighting with your sibling, mm-hmm. monitoring whether you're—
counting your TV time.
Yeah, are you peeing on the floor? Like this type of thing. I mean, part of
kids are used to a surveillance state.
Yeah, exactly. Part of being a child is that you're not just—
And you lie so much. Yeah, you're like, no, right. I didn't put the fork in the microwave.
And when you're—
You didn't.
When you're—
There's three people here, and you're the seven-year-old.
So they were particularly, you know, kind of powered by Krista. They were aware of book fairs and toy fairs.
They knew that there were places you could sell an elf.
Yeah, and there the QVC example is, I think, in the United States, there have always been inventors who wanted to take their, you know, their new mouse trap to one of these conventions, and hopefully it would get picked up by some—
It explains company. Shark Tank.
But Shark Tank is a perfect example of how much that now is a known part of our culture. And the
that's how you think invention works. It's not a lab at 3M. It's some lady
nut.
In her kitchen with a sketch.
And children's books and children's toys— Because as we've explored on the show, there have been so many of these phenomena since the 80s, Cabbage Patch and little—
Toy fads. Tickle Me Elmo and Tamagotchi.
And so many of them kind of do come out of this hula hoop invented by somebody in their garage, or pickleball, for example, that become multi-million dollar industries. So there are trade fairs and book fairs that really focus on finding the sellable thing and marketing it. And so the mother and her two daughters kind of went to all of these, spent a couple of years really kind of— they felt like they had a hot ticket here, and they were going to go try and get it sold. And it was illustrated by Coe Steinwart, who did a very traditional looking illustration. The whole thing really did feel
like
something.
It's supposed to look like an age-old heritage.
Yeah, from the 50s, if not from the 1880s. And they eventually, and this is the wonderful thing, when you read all of the literature about all the both the hagiography of Elf on a Shelf and also all the critical commentary on Elf on a Shelf.
I've never heard any of this, so you can tell me anything.
I'll
believe it.
Every article says, you know, by 2008, they had won the Best Toy Award as presented by Learning Express. They'd won the Book of the Year Award at the Creative Child Awards. And then they won the National Best Book Award from USA Book News.
I have never heard of any of these awards, but I am willing to believe that that's really good for them to get them.
Well, it's really good because it was obviously in a press release because it's quoted everywhere. Mm-hmm. But the best toy award from Learning Express, Learning Express is a toy store chain, and the best toy award is the toy award is an award that they give to.
Oh, it's like a sales award?
Yeah, it's like, it's not reflective of sales. It's just something they kind of send out to their chain and say this is a good toy.
We're going to be pushing this. It's almost like the employee picks at a bookstore or a video store.
Exactly. So when you see Learning Express, I mean, all of these awards, the way they're presented in the literature is that these were
great acclaim.
Yeah, and put together by Common Sense Media, where it's a bunch of educators and parents deciding like what the best children's toys are.
Mm-hmm. Nope, but in fact, no panel ever.
The Creative Child Awards are again just a kind of a sales and marketing award, and then the National Best Book Awards from USA Book News. We should do an episode on vanity prizes because it's like a vanity prize. If you submit the $69 application fee,
you are the best book
to USA Book News. They will give you a sticker that says one of the best books of the year by US Book News.
It's true that I've been in publishing a long time and I am not aware of USA Book News.
Yeah.
Oh, so, but if you search online, it goes to selfpublishingnews.com. Yeah, they're not exactly Kirkus.
No. But by 2008, on the strength of those three awards, but largely on the strength of the fact that this was a kind of an irresistible toy, you're looking at now a new generation of millennial parents that are presumably looking for traditions that reflect Christmas that, you know, they're probably, I think that generation now is two generations removed from a connection to a Bing Crosby Christmas. It no longer feels contemporary. And this is probably a generation that's grown up with dolls and toys and marketing all being somewhat intertwined, so it doesn't feel as chemical to them.
Remember how the theme of a Charlie Brown Christmas is, what if Christmas became a commercial enterprise?
Right. You can tell it was so against it.
It must have been top of mind in the mid to late 60s because there's a bunch of TV specials where it's like, no, shopping should not take over Christmas. It's really about what Luke chapter 2, I think, is Linus's take.
Right. Linus sits and looks up at the star.
Don't go to the mall, Charlie Brown. Whereas, and by 2008, that discussion is over.
And in the 1970s and even into the 80s, I remember feeling, especially in the 70s, feeling very spooky around Christmas in a positive way, but feeling like we didn't go to church, but the spirits, the connection to good and fellowship and brotherhood of all men were really in the air. I can put myself right in my mother's living room watching the blinking lights on the tree and looking out at the snow coming down and just feeling like connected, my heart open.
It's easy to say, well, that just, the media got you. All those JCPenney wish book catalogs and all the TV commercials.
For sure.
For jewelry and chocolates, those all worked their magic, except that like Charles Dickens, the Victorians described the same kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Like it's solstice related, maybe long nights and the need for light and community.
Yeah. I think Christmas obviously goes back a long way.
This is your, that's your little known historical take.
But
Christmas is a land of contrasts.
Christmas as we celebrate it is really, really an American holiday. And I mean, the first real mention of Santa Claus is a Washington Irving.
We were open to a Dutch influence that they were scorning in London.
Right.
We were like, no, Dutch, please come teach us about your bearded men.
And that original Santa Claus was portrayed as a fat Dutch sailor smoking a pipe and wearing a green jacket, which was a caricature of like a Dutchman early
1800s. Not a Turkish archbishop.
And each one of the little traditions, like the sleigh and reindeer, night before Christmas, those are 1820s. As we were saying, Thomas Nast. Yeah,
American was a magazine, newspaper cartoons.
Yeah, and his first Santa Claus was actually wrapped in an American flag because it was during the Civil War and Santa was presented as like pro-Union.
Of course he would be.
Yeah, of course.
Not that Dutch one. He's a little problematic.
In 1897, Francis Church wrote that editorial in the New York Sun where he was replying to a girl saying, is Santa Claus real? Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus.
No culture, no other country is keeping up with us in generating Christmas lore.
Yeah.
Nobody's even trying.
No, we're really into it. And I think a lot of it was trying to connect ourselves to the old world and say, like, America, we do have all these influences and it is, we do have traditions in a country that kind of isn't really founded on, like, ancient traditions.
And then once the balance of socioeconomic power starts to move to the Western Hemisphere, then, you know, Coca-Cola has the ability to show people an impression of Santa that no German engraver or Danish newspaper columnist, you know, ever could.
Right. And Coca-Cola, that stuff comes in the 1930s, but, you know, a little bit earlier, Frank Baum starts to establish that Santa has a social conscience, that he's delivering presents to poor children.
This is the Oz guy?
Yeah.
He has Santa, his take on Santa?
He does.
I didn't know
He's the one that established that Santa was immortal, but not as a saint, not as a religious character, but like as a fantasy.
Other people used to imagine and paint the death of Santa, but L. Frank Baum was like, nope.
Nope.
I know you've been thinking a lot, you goths have been thinking a lot about how Santa's going to eat it, but
Christmas was problematic to a lot of people, the whole holiday, let alone Santa. I mean, the Calvinists and the Puritans were against Christmas.
Sure.
As a pagan holiday.
It was illegal in some, wasn't it illegal in Massachusetts Bay Colony?
Yeah.
In
Santa,
colonial times?
Even into the 20th century, was described as a heathen goblin.
That's still how I think of him.
As a heathen goblin?
Yeah. Even when my kids sit on his lap, I'm like, oh. Go say hi to the heathen goblin.
But Marxists outlawed Christmas and Santa in all of their many...
Here's your horseshoe theory. It's back.
Right. That's right. It's many, and all of its many incarnations.
The far
right
and the far left all hate Christmas.
But the response to the enormous success and what seemed, I think, at first like a Cabbage Patch Kids level, benign, sort of new Christmas
toy fad.
The mid-2000s, 2009 and 10, were kind of a perfect storm, I guess, where maybe there was the absence of a moral panic, or maybe it was kind of a like peak moral panic times.
One of those.
But there was an enormous critical response. It, from the child psychology, the child psychology industrial complex, editorials and papers being written about Elf on a Shelf,
really,
as promoting a surveillance culture, promoting a kind of fascist.
You're going to give your kids nightmares and eating disorders.
Nightmares and eating disorders, but also what you're doing is training them to accept. This was right after the NSA was revealed to have been spying on American citizens. Mm. And so a lot of these articles would touch on the idea that this was teaching a generation of kids to be compliant to a sort of nanny state surveillance state.
We need government ties. We need to find out if there's government ties with the Shonda and Chris, the Ebersold family. Like, who paid them off?
That's right. And it might have been, you know, it's hard to, none of them overtly said, these are Southern white women who are promoting this as a kind of QVC level lowbrow toy marketing thing. And as, you know, as writers for The Atlantic or whatever, we're going to kind of disembowel it almost from a from a class standpoint. Right. Nobody does. Nobody says it explicitly, but there is the sort of ivory tower, like, this is just a scheme.
I hope it was just more yo-yo columnists than actual academics, because for years, child psychologists have been like, it's fine, lie to your kids about Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, Santa Claus, it's fine, you know, like, the traditions are good, it'll help sharpen their cognitive tools, but now this is a bridge too far, apparently.
Well, a very influential article was published in Psychology Today by a fairly influential public intellectual by the name of David Kyle Johnson, who was a graduate of Oklahoma. He was born in 1977, so he's a late Gen Xer. University of Oklahoma psychologist and philosopher. He'd written several kind of philosophical treatises. Wrote an influential article that really tried to expose the elf on a shelf as a part of the Santa lie that was pernicious in American childhood.
So Santa can be wielded in okay ways, but this kind of thing.
Well, he actually wrote a book called The Myth That Stole Christmas. And he was a very influential scholar in saying we should abolish Santa.
He's one of the abolish Santa guys.
And so
I once had a church Christmas party that a chunk of the congregation boycotted due to an argument over whether Santa should come or not. And it wasn't from a theological point of view, is this not Jesus-y enough if Santa comes? It was really like, you can never lie to your kids. Don't you read McCall's?
And this article didn't come out until 2012, and there was already a whole sub-market of articles about how this was a surveillance state.
It's the ultimate hot take.
Training.
To say Santa is bad.
That's right. But this, the 2012, connecting it to not only, because he also talked about surveillance state, but connecting it really to the idea that you were making presents contingent on good behavior that you were performing as a result of being surveilled.
You're going to mess up the kid's internal moral compass.
That's right.
They're just going to do...
Kids should be good irrespective of being watched. And that lying to kids means that you're going to lose their trust. They're going to lose trust in all adult sort of institutions. At one point, there was an article... by a writer named Hank Stoiver, who wrote a book called Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present, but Christmas Present,
Christmas Present, he's doing there.
Who said that essentially that believing in Santa leads to kids growing up believing in a merchandise culture that will sort of inevitably result in girls wanting $100,000 weddings and people believing in weapons of mass destruction that don't
more
exist.
Materialist.
And what it...
He had data, I guess?
I mean, it's hard to connect the Santa lie to $100,000 weddings through data. I mean, and there's...
Just ask a bunch of bridezillas if they believed in Santa and what age.
I mean, because there's a lot of this critical... quasi-consensus is connected to, there is a lot of statistics supporting that we're becoming a more materialistic culture. And I think there's a sense that people are becoming more culpable, that they just believe what they're told. And trying to connect those things to causes, it's easy to look at what's our most commercial holiday. What is... What are our traditions that most turn us into like cheap product whores?
And it is like you talk about like how influential that, how large Christmas looms in your childhood memories and pantheon. And it does seem like you would start at Christmas if you want to see what shapes an American kid.
That's right. Although at what point did I, because as much as I sat looking out at the snow and thinking of the little drummer boy and the little matchstick girl, mm-hmm. all these extremely sentimental ideas of away in a manger, no crib for a bed. I mean, that's all part of the story of Christianity that really connects it to the social awareness of people that are poor and estranged, and how Jesus comes and represents
right.
the very weakest of our society.
He doesn't come in glory. He's like a baby who's going to freeze to death if nobody helps.
So even, and this was, I think, part of the mid-century, like there was never such a great church attendance as there was in 1959, right? It was the absolute peak of American religiosity.
Mm-hmm.
By 1978, those numbers were in decline. And I was a secular child, but Jesus and the story of Christmas, and we didn't go all the way to overturning the tables of the moneylenders, in my house at least. We weren't quite that, like, we didn't talk about it in July. But at this time of year, the spirit of giving, the spirit of the Salvation Army, right? This was a time of charity. And you could connect it to Christianity without necessarily believing in Christianity.
Right, without being a churchgoer, you're still going to believe
in Jesus is emblematic of a kind of care and concern.
Mm-hmm.
And so that existed simultaneously with my desire to have a Han Solo blaster under my Christmas tree, right? Like,
it all felt like the same thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh no, there's this tension in Christmas. It was like, no, that's the time when you get gifts and you give gifts and think about others.
Yeah, exactly. There was a kitten under our tree one winter, and there couldn't have been a better Christmas present in all of time.
Right.
And to then by 1995 feel like we were living in the materialistic culture that had been predicted sort of throughout the 20th century or throughout the 19th century, to have finally be living in that hell, but to not connect it to global trade, cheap manufacturing, mass marketing, but connect it to the Christmas holiday and
don't blame Santa.
I mean, It is
got to be a rounding error compared to the other changes.
It is a little bit like finding the cause of a thing that you'd like to explain,
and also just the need to have something outrageous to say, or it's not a book. You know, you're not going to get on the Today Show if you say, this is what cheap manufacturing does.
Yeah, if you think about all of these articles, and there were articles in Atlantic, Vox, I mean, basically, and it really split it was on both sides of the political spectrum. There were a lot of...
Yeah, I'm sure the New Republic and the National Review both had
examples
of... The problem with Santa.
That's right. And the problem with this surveillance elf.
Yeah.
And the problem with connecting... and there was a lot of, I think from one side of the conservatives, a lot of like, why do you have to ruin Christmas? And there, you know, there was that battle too, but plenty of people found at least a talking point. And in fact, David Kyle Johnson actually appeared on Sean Hannity, and they debated.
And Hannity was pro Santa.
Hannity was,
and this guy was the liberal scold.
Exactly, Hannity was pro Elf on a Shelf because it was just a fun. Why do the liberals have to hate everything thing? And Johnson,
which is funny because, like, they could easily do the "you're taking Christ out of Christmas" angle if you wanted to,
or nowadays the QAnon, like, this is preparing us to be watched by the nanny state.
It could swing back the other way,
and it's liberals that want to put this little toy. I mean, I think if maybe the Ebersolds, and I, you know, it's the Ebersold family, but the daughter that helped write the book is, her married name is Chanda Bell, and Krista's married name is Krista Pitts.
Did they both make a ton of money?
Krista and Chanda are co-CEOs of the company, and they eventually incorporated as their company is called Lumistella Co. And none of this critical hullabaloo really affected sales of Elf on a Shelf in any way other than promoting it constantly, to the point that in 2013, it was the number one toy.
Really? Top-selling toy of the year?
In 2012...
Let's give them a made-up award.
The Elf was in the Macy's parade.
Mm.
They started in 2013 the Elf on a Shelf birthday tradition.
Oh, man.
Where the Elf comes and decorates your special birthday chair.
Profits are always down in January. What do we do? I could not picture the Elf on the Shelf. I just realized.
Well, look at it, because it looks like an elf that's sitting on a shelf.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
but he is a little bit Chucky, right? He's a little bit creepy.
Yeah, I mean, all dolls are creepy,
I guess. But like, he's not. He could be more cuddly, you know. The fact that his eyes are to the side really are like, I'm spying on you.
Yeah, well, he is. He's spying on you, but
he's kind of a coy little elf. He's not a.
He's coy.
He's not a. He could have been designed as a more friendly, reassuring presence, is what I'm saying.
Well, and so what I think happened was Elf on a Shelf became a social media phenomenon, both in this like hot take culture, but also in cottagecore, Facebook, and then Instagram culture. Parents started to try and outdo each other in terms of creating places the elf was hiding, and then pretty soon the kids would wake up and the elf would be hanging from a chandelier. Like covered in streamers.
It's like mommy blogger stuff.
Yeah, gradually the elf was doing all these things that would be considered bad behavior if the kids did it. You know, the elf became impish. And then there was a new spate of articles talking about how Elf on a Shelf culture was putting undue pressure on parents at the worst time of the year. Right.
They're already busy and they have to figure this out every day.
Now they're competing with each other and to have the best Elf on a Shelf story because the kids are talking about it, I guess, at school. What did your elf do? Oh, my elf is in the toilet.
I want to ask my kids if any of their friends had Elf on the Shelf because, you know, the chronology is not crazy. Like, we could have been Elf on the Shelf parents.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Your kids were born when?
Yeah, 2002 and 2006.
That would have been key.
It's right down the plate.
Right when Elf on a Shelf arrived.
This is maybe the first time in history that any holiday tradition like this has come with a brand. You know, in the past, if you were interested in doing an advent calendar, 100 places would sell you an advent calendar. If you wanted a Santa suit, you did not have to get, you know, Kirkland Industries brand Santa suit. But now, one country controls the IP and the distribution of Elf on the Shelf.
Right. And there were always Mickey Mouse as Santa Claus or whatever, but you could not, I mean, and I suppose you could get any doll and call it an Elf on a Shelf and put it up on
right. I'm sure there's a Dollar Tree option here, but for the most part, they have a monopoly.
Well, and the book that accompanies the doll is in verse, and it is sort of charming, and it lays out the story of the elf where it's not like the elf is coming in and watching you masturbate. You know, it's the elf is nice and
they cut that part out.
I mean, you're essentially, the elf is giving you the benefit of the doubt. It's not watching you wipe.
He's given a character and it's a good character. So yeah, if you take the totality of the mythos, all the David Kyle whatevers, can take a deep breath.
Well, and there's tons of pushback from psychologists saying, look, kids, we tell kids all kinds of things. At the age of 5, 85% of kids believe in Santa. And by the age of 8, only, you know, less than 25% do.
That's the argument. It's a natural process.
And it's often seen that losing a belief in Santa is seen, I think, by kids as a rite of passage, as a sign that they're getting older and more mature, that they don't believe in Santa anymore. They don't typically report, children don't typically report feeling lied to and betrayed. they feel like, oh, I'm in on it now.
I guess the argument from the other side is like, well, they wouldn't know. You know, it's a, they don't have the language to describe what that's doing to their little brains. But it is, it does seem weird that nobody at the time is describes it as a hurt.
Yeah, and I think that there's a there's recognized a real distinction between using as a parent using Santa to coerce. If you're sitting there going, "Don't do that, or Santa will hate your guts." It's very different than, oh, Santa is bringing presents down the chimney and let's leave cookies out for him. You know, well, there is a benign, and I think the majority of the Santa story is presented pretty benignly, and not as a way of threatening kids with coal.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly was never told that some behavior was going to result in Santa like trying to smother me in the night. And I don't know about you.
No, it all seemed very academic.
Yeah,
you know, I have to say I did not have, I remember the media's depiction of Santa in his sleigh, Santa coming down chimneys. I don't really remember visceral ideas of Santa in our house or imagining him.
You didn't leave milk and cookies out for Santa?
We did, I guess.
Except you lived in Korea, there were no fireplaces.
No chimney. It did yeah. just, it, but it just seemed like lore, you know? It just seemed like something you do.
Yeah, right.
The same way you count down at New Year's.
Well, Elf in a Shelf has continued to grow. In 2019, there was, by 2019, Elf in a Shelf was part of the Kellogg's cereal empire. IHOP had Elf in a Shelf promotions. Ooh. There was a stage musical.
What do you think market penetration is like? Like if 80% of households pretend Santa's coming, what's Elf on the Shelf?
Well, like Elf on a Shelf now is $100 million a year business. And that's really not even factoring in a deal they did with Netflix in 2020 for a potential series, a series of movies. Netflix has got a whole Elf on a Shelf kind of empire percolating.
Of households, YouGov survey says of households with young children, 36% say they do Elf on the Shelf.
36%. Mm. Both Bell and Pitts are worth about $50 million now as CEOs of this massive enterprise. There are more than 22 million dolls out there. So just
collecting data.
Yeah.
Still reporting back.
That's right. The Loomis Della Corporation has just recently partnered with the Beaches Resort chain, and they now have like for families that spend Christmas in the Turks and Caicos or in
make sure there's one in your cabin
in Jamaica. Well, not only that, but the whole experience of your Christmas vacation is like butler curated Elf on a Shelf themed. Like the elf is here with us here. And
I do think there's a lot of people who think they could compete with Disney Cruises, and they cannot compete with Disney Cruises, but somebody must be going on those. And yet we didn't do it this year. You didn't think you'd unveil Elf on the Shelf for your daughter?
Well, that's the thing. This episode is coming after Christmas, so it's either going to...
I guess you have time. You could do, or do you think you're going to try it?
I mean, you could start... I'm not going to. My daughter's 13. This is the first year that she's probably going to be like, ugh, okay, fine. I mean, she still likes the presents, but there's not. I don't know how much she's going to want to sit in kumbaya with me, looking at the blinking lights and looking out at the snow and thinking, goodwill to all men.
We missed our chance.
Yeah.
We missed our chance.
But for those parents who are listening who are like, we do Elf on the Shelf and it's amazing. We want to support you. And for those parents listening who are like, we never did Elf on the Shelf because it's part of a surveillance state and like a capitalist conspiracy.
I'm just going to say it. Both these takes are wrong. There is one correct take on Elf on the Shelf, and it was mine, which is, what is that?
What?
And that concludes Elf on the Shelf, entry 404.PR1503, certificate number 45509. In the Omnibus. Omnibus was a product of its time and was therefore a social media presence for a while. There's probably relics of at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick and at Omnibus Project on various platforms. I guess if you're still on one of the microblogging sites, Omnibus Out of Context, is fun. That's like,
I like it.
That's as close to the as any Omnibus social media presence as there is right now.
It's weird, but fun.
That's not true. There's the Futurelings on Patreon who are fun. And really all the good stuff's at patreon.com/omnibusproject. We'll give you your omnibus-loving loved one the gift this year of a Patreon membership.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
And they'll be listening to exclusive premium content, early ad-free content, all the year round as they keep Christmas in their hearts.
It's a nice thing to do in the week between Christmas and New Year.
This year, the week between is Hanukkah. Did you know that?
Oh, that almost never happens.
Hanukkah begins, I mean, if you're listening on the 26th, it's the first full day of Hanukkah. Yesterday was the first night. Hey, yesternight.
Mazel tov.
You can send us physical items. I guess there's an email address, theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Send us your own Elf on the Shelf testimonials. Mm-hmm. Tell us if you were scarred by it or chose to scar your children or both. I mean, really, that's what generational trauma is for, right?
That's right.
We are getting to the people who hated Elf on the Shelf as kids and now have their own kids to inflict it on. Like, we're coming up on
That's right.
First generation.
So is that right? If you got Elf on a Shelf in 2008 and you were 8.
Yeah, now you're 23. Yeah,
you're 23. You could start torturing your own children
soon.
With
yeah, very exciting.
Nanny state.
That'll be the thing that I'm sure Luna Stella is worried about. How do we keep the first Elfie kids with their own shelfies.
Elfies with shelfies.
The physical items could be sent to us at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Got some mail here. Although, the last couple of times I went to pick up mail, this particular 98155 post office is in a state of disrepair.
You have to go to different post offices to get these different...
No, I don't.
Okay. I was going
to
say.
No matter what zip code you put down, it eventually gets to 98155. And now they are redoing the lobby, which means you can't access your P.O. box. You have to go in while the post office is open and have somebody and wait in the line for somebody to get you your stuff.
Oh, come on.
It's really the worst thing that's ever happened
I'm
to me.
I'm extremely surprised that you actually do all that. I would think that you would be like, nope.
Often it's Mindy, like if she's on some kind of run up north, if she's on her way to Costco or Fred Meyer.
Right, that makes sense.
She'll hit the post office.
She has more patience for that kind of thing.
I did it last Saturday and I was like, this line looks pretty long. But they were moving at a pretty good clip. Thank you, U.S. Postal Service. But really, don't close your P.O. boxes. And I picked this, let's see, Gigi and Harris it must be a mother and a son who both listen to Omnibus. That's nice. That's fun. Twin beds. I hope their respective father and grandfather, her father, his grandpa, was a career CIA intelligence officer.
Oh, an elf on the shelf, if you will.
He's sending us CIA stuff. When he died in 98, he left his family a scarf that they used to give pilots during the Vietnam War.
Oh, it's a map scarf?
You've heard of these, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's a neckerchief that is also a map of the Gulf of Tonkin. And and regions northward. Is it the same on both sides? Oh, no, this appears to be more inland. Like, this is, what do we got here? We got South Vietnam here.
Yeah, this is if you get shot down, you use this to find your way back to, presumably the...
Oh, I see. It's horizontal. Okay, I'm holding it wrong. So the map, the way the text is written in both Chinese and in Roman text, I think north is to the...
Well, I look forward to seeing it one day.
Well, I'm having too much fun with it.
So what other CIA stuff did he leave them?
We only have one. I will
like a
I
poison
will
tipped cane.
They were trying to figure out what to do with it and thought of us. If you need to get the wrinkles out, toss it in the dryer on steam. The CIA is sending us care instructions. Thank you, Gigi and Harris. Isn't that fantastic?
This is really wonderful. Oh my God, this is wonderful.
We'll cut out all the blank space where I was just staring transfixed at it. Because now you're going to stare transfixed at it.
Staring transfixed at it. Oh, my God. And it's in such great condition. I wonder what he did in the CIA. I really want to know more.
Well, it's probably classified.
I'm going to wear that now. I'm going to wear that all the time.
And then...
Thank you for not caring about that stuff, Ken. It makes it so much easier.
No, I would love that. I wrote a whole book about maps, but it's the season of giving.
That's true.
What else do we have here? Oh, it's a very modern art-themed card from Melissa, who says, oh, wow, we were reminiscing about the 60s World Fair, although we're too young to reminisce about it. And she sent us this art book that was released in 62 to celebrate the fair.
That's
called
a cool book.
Called Art Since 1950. Melissa points out that it's neat to see who was an emerging artist. For example, she has flagged
Morris Graves.
A black and white reproduction of a young up-and-comer named Mark Rothko.
Oh. If only we could go back and buy one of those paintings for $1,500.
I mean, it does really show you that Rothko does not work in black and white.
Right. But those ombre paintings are really hard to appreciate.
There's a few color plates. This is really great, Melissa. Thank you for sending this. And because it's the end of the year, I got a note from none other than the Kentucky Colonels, hoping that I will not only re-up, but also buy a ton of merch.
Yeah.
Here's their catalog. There's challenge coins. There's hats. There's a polo shirt. It's pretty much the three things a Southern man wants. A challenge coin, a polo, and a hat.
Yeah, my problem
is also a shot glass.
Because they send me, I'm surprised you only get it once a year, because I get it once a week.
Oh, I don't get that many. But I got it a few times.
But for sure, they want to sell me golf clothes. And that makes sense. It's mm-hmm. a Kentucky Colonels. It's not like the San Francisco Colonels. But I don't want any more polo shirts.
I've kind of decided, I used to be like all polos at some point in my life. And now I'm no polo. There was never a time when I wore a sensible number of polos. It's all or nothing for me.
What happens when you decide, like, no more polos? Do all your polos go to the thrift store, or do you have a closet of polos?
Yeah, they kind of stay on the side of the closet rod where nothing gets drawn from.
Yeah.
I feel like for most men, it's you get a tummy and then you don't wear polos. Is that
they don't look
is that
as
what
good
it is?
With the tummy, yeah, like when, for sure.
A button-down kind of hangs a little more.
Yeah. The polo really exposes the crimes.
But the golfers who do wear polos don't seem to worry. You know, they look just as awful. They look worse in them than you and I would, and yet still they polo.
One of the things that happened in the early 2000s indie rock was that tight t-shirts were the fashion, and it did not... tight t-shirts were the fashion, but you didn't have to be fit. And I remember early 2000s going like, what is going on? Like, why is everyone's shirt too tight?
Not everybody was ultra-marathoning like Ben Gibbard.
No, but then I realized a very key thing, and you get this when you see pictures of yourself on stage, and that is that loose-fitting clothes do not make you look thin.
Mm.
And if you are a chubbins, like I am, and you wear clothes that you would look at and go, that's too tight for someone who's a little bit on the thick boy side, and you compare it to a picture of yourself the night before when you're wearing a loose-fitting thing.
Your nice caftan.
You actually look kind of slimmer just by virtue of wearing slim-fit clothes. And the fact that you're chubby doesn't...
I think that is the realization that led to yoga pants. Like, maybe you need to do more shows in leggings.
I wonder what that would look like. Well, there was a skinny jeans phase where I went to Uniqlo and bought a bunch of jeans that were effectively leggings. But that's not my... I don't look... I mean, I've got great legs, don't get me wrong.
Ladies?
But you know, I'm not like...
I never switched... When the Junko jeans came back, I never switched back. I still have my...
Your skinny
my
jeans.
Very, they're probably slim straight, you know? I'm the real slim straighty. The thing I love about getting stuff from the Kentucky Colonels is somebody, whoever signed me up as Ken Jennings, but the field must have had like, is there a middle name? Is there a suffix? And this enterprising soul went to my Wikipedia, apparently.
Oh, and put Wayne.
Well, now all my stuff comes to Colonel Ken Wayne Jennings III. So it's not, it's Ken Wayne. You know, it's a nickname, but then it's the whole thing. So I really do sound like a Kentucky Colonel.
Ken Wayne Jennings III.
Ken Wayne Jennings.
His barbecue sauce is world class.
Thank you so much to all who contributed there. And I already did everything else. Futurelings, blah, blah, blah. Don't forget the Patreon. 'Tis the season.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese, and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.